I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Liberals in Kansas had high hopes when Laura Kelly became governor in January. Since then, the Kelly administration has slogged its way through a single lawmaking session and battled with Republicans almost every step of the way. So has the Democratic governor lived up to expectations? Today, we put that question to the chief executive herself. She's in the studio for the first time since being elected. During the hour, we'll get Kelly's thoughts on Medicaid expansion, tax cuts, and tax revenues. And for a candidate who stressed bipartisanship, we'll ask what it's been like working with a legislative leadership that appears to resist that idea. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas Governor Laura Kelly got through her first session as governor despite fierce Republican resistance to a host of her initiatives. One of her top priorities, Medicaid expansion, fell just a little short. She vetoed a tax cut measure that Republicans wanted, also left undone reforms to the state's troubled child welfare system. But she got an increase in school funding that finally satisfied the Kansas Supreme Court and more funding for state prisons, which we talked about yesterday on this show. That still won't solve all the system's problems. Governor Laura Kelly joins me here in the studio, and welcome back. So nice to have you here,
hey,
Governor.
Hey, Steve, it's great to be here.
You know, just guessing here, after the election and the whirl of putting together a staff and a budget, and then you plunge into your first session, that maybe the summer brings a little bit of a relief for a first-term governor or not?
Oh, not much, because in addition to all I was doing there, I also had a daughter who just got married.
No kidding.
And so we had all of that going on. And I just have another daughter who just moved cross-country from Portland, Oregon to Durham, North Carolina. So what I'm not doing in the office, I'm spending a lot of time family-wise.
So I've got to ask, what was the higher priority for you, your daughter's wedding or the state of Kansas during that time?
Well, if she were asking me, of course. Her wedding was the very most important thing in my life. But fortunately, my daughter and her now husband are sort of organizational freaks, and I really had very little to do with it other than show up. But
why am I not surprised to hear that? Being a daughter of Laura Kelly. What does a governor do in the summertime?
Well, we've been extraordinarily busy. First of all, rounding out my cabinet. We were able to recruit and attract some really top-notch folks to the cabinet to help us get through this first session. Some of them only came on temporarily, though. You know, Dwayne Gosin in Department of Administration and Roger Warholz in Corrections,
right.
To name two. We have found permanent replacements for them. And so both of those secretaries have just started this past Monday. And so we've got that done. And then there are just, you know, probably literally thousands of other appointments to boards and commissions that have to be done, many of which were left neglected for years to come. So we're really focusing on that, really beefing up sort of the government infrastructure,
yeah,
to allow it to function.
You know, as you look back at the last 7 or 8 months of your life, you know, the run-up to the election, then your victory, followed by this whirlwind of putting together a staff and a budget and an inaugural address, is it all just a giant blur?
No, it's actually not. And I know that that may sound not real, but no, it's been very clear. You know, we were very focused during the campaign with the goal of getting elected. Then the transition was laser-like, and we knew we needed to get a team in. I had to get the budget put together to give to the legislature the day after I was inaugurated. So, no, it was all very, very focused, and we have been like that through the session. You know, we had very clear goals on what we wanted to get done, and we just, as a team, focused on getting that done. And no, it's pretty crystal clear.
You know, I'm not sure what you do about it, but is it all too much too fast? I mean, there are so many heavy duties that a new governor has to take care of and satisfy in those first few weeks, including the writing of a budget, revising the budget that your predecessor has put together. I mean, that's a lot of stuff.
It is a lot of stuff, but there are two things I think worked in my favor. One, I had been on the budget committee for 14 years, so reviewing the budget was not new to me. I absolutely understood every single line item in the budget. And so while it was tedious and time consuming, it wasn't puzzling to me at all. So that was relatively easy to do. And actually, in my nerd-like way, it was fun. But the other thing that really was extraordinarily helpful was a number of people, you know, dedicated to the state of Kansas who wanted to come back and provide public service. And so,
like Dwayne Gosin.
Like Dwayne. And, yeah. You know, I just had a really top-notch team, experienced, knowledgeable, motivated, who were able to come in and really help me put things together. So I felt like when we walked in the governor's office on day one, I was what I said I would be all during the campaign. I was ready to get to work.
Well, what surprised you most about the job?
I think the fact that, I have to get things done through other people. You know, when I was a state senator, I was pretty much a solo operator. Yeah, yeah, I did it. I didn't have staff. I didn't have any, really a lot of people, doing my work for me. I had to get that done. So working through other folks to get things done is different. But it's also been extraordinarily rewarding because of the caliber of people that we've been able to bring back into the administration.
Yeah.
These are nationally known, recognized leaders in their particular fields, and they are working hard and really moving us forward.
Kansas Governor Laura Kelly is my guest. You said in a rather well-known line after you took over that the fiscal challenges facing the state were even greater than you had anticipated. And again, this was coming from someone, as you just said, who had spent 14 years on the budget committee. What were you talking about?
Well, the difference between being on the budget committee and being governor is that, you know, I have access to all the books now. Agencies don't necessarily show it all to the legislature. They're not required to, and they don't. But when you're in the agency, you actually can open up the books and you can see where everything's is or is not. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. You know, we began to see, you know, how deep I understood that there were problems in our agencies, a lot of them. You know, they had leadership issues, and they had revenue issues and staffing issues. But to get in there and see how bad it really was startling, but also challenging. And I think that the cabinet secretaries that we've got in there, you know, are fully aware. They did deep dives, and they are working to put those agencies back together.
You know, you face some pretty fierce, I'm putting it mildly, Republican opposition to almost all things Laura Kelly in the past session. Republicans didn't like your budget. They didn't like your call for swift action on school funding. They wanted to cut taxes when you were elected on a platform of returning some financial balance to the state. Were you surprised by the ferocity of it all, or did you expect it all along?
No, I knew that would be there. But if you really look, it was not Republicans generically opposing everything that I wanted to get done. It was Republican leadership. And when you got around that, and I working just with the rank and file, and I did that a lot. You know, I had those folks into my office. I wandered around the Capitol going into their office to sit down and talk about issues. And so I think that's why we were able to be as successful as we were.
Yeah.
We got the school finance was a bipartisan agreement. We were able to sustain the vetoes on the tax cuts, which were imperative if we're really going to keep Kansas on track to fiscal sanity. So, and that was because of the 14 years I had been working in the Senate and had established relationships across the aisle, across chambers, and I was able to build on those relationships and get some things.
You know, one member of that Senate leadership team you just referred to is the Senate President, Susan Weigle. She's considering a run for the U.S. Senate next year. In your view, did she let politics get in the way of doing her job as the leader of that chamber?
Well, you know, I've never known President Weigle to be any other way than the way that she was this session.
Meaning highly political.
Well, you know, I think she sees that as her role. And, you know, I don't see my role as an elected official to be in there fighting for my political party or an ideology, but rather to do the work needed by the citizens of Kansas. So Susan and I just have a very different approach to governing.
You know, just 2 weeks ago, President Weigle made it clear that she didn't expect you to be a two-term governor. And she said that you lack the depth of relationships, and I'm quoting, that Democratic Governor Kathleen Sebelius once had. She said this, it just feels to me that Laura doesn't have a knowledgeable group of people helping her to be a successful governor, who is vetting her nominees, who are very engaged in policy. So I don't expect her to be there long. What do you say to that?
Hogwash. You know, I mean, the fact of the matter is that it is because of the relationships that I have, one, that I was able to get elected, and two, that we were able to get so much done this session. So I just think that she's throwing that out there in hopes that it'll stick. I'm very confident that, you know, we have put together a team, both inside the state government, but also outside, to ensure that we can move forward with our agenda, which I believe strongly is the agenda of the Kansas people.
I don't want to make too much of it, but what do you make of the fact, though, that one of the top leaders in the state of Kansas is throwing axes at the end of a legislative session in the way that she is?
Well, I think it goes back to your suggestion that she's running for higher office. And so there's a lot of positioning that goes on, preening that goes on to, you know, look at me. I'm the most conservative person here. I'm the one who will battle the Democrats, you know, and that's important in a Republican primary.
But the trick here is this was your first session. You had just been elected. You had just had assumed office. Americans, as we both know, are clamoring for more bipartisan cooperation. And then you come across this, which is just the polar opposite of it. You get frustrated?
No, I don't get frustrated. You know,
You roll with it.
First of all, I've been in the legislature for a long time, and my approach to problem solving is never to get frustrated, but rather to find a way around the issues and come to some sort of compromise and reasonable solutions.
We're visiting with Kansas Governor Laura Kelly. Let's turn to some issues here, Governor, and Medicaid expansion tops my list. Kansas and Missouri remain two of 14 states that have not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Proponents tried hard this session to get it done, really hard. It was one of your priorities, too. This would expand health coverage to lots of poor Kansans. Was there ever a point this year when you thought you were going to get it done?
I was cautiously optimistic that we might be able to find reasonable common ground with Senate leadership, because that's really where the problem was. Mm-hmm. You know, the House passed Medicaid expansion, and there were enough votes on the Senate floor to pass Medicaid expansion as we presented it. There were obstacles just in Senate leadership, and I kept hoping that they would sort of see the light and realize that this was in the best interests of Kansas, and that the money was there in the budget to get this done. All the excuses were gone now. There was no reason not to do it. And I was hoping that they'd come around and do what was in the best interests of so many Kansans, including our economy. But that was not to be.
Republicans said they needed more time to vet this policy, to vet this issue. What do you think about that?
There have been endless numbers of studies and research done on Medicaid expansion. You know, we also now have 5 years of other states who expanded Medicaid, so we know what the results have been there. And almost all of those results point to how sound a policy it was to expand. You know, states that have expanded it have seen their economies grow, job growth, more people being able to work because they're healthy and they have insurance. I mean, it just, you know, the positives, you know, so outweigh any of the negatives. And quite honestly, I can't think of a whole lot of negatives that that have actually occurred in states that have done it. So there's no excuse. There's no need for more study. There's just a need to get it done.
You know, Republicans, as you well know, have promised to allow the measure to come forward next session, with Senate Majority Leader Jim Denning promising what he's called a more robust bill. How confident are you that you're going to see a more robust bill next session?
Well, I know that the Senate just put together a select committee that will be studying Medicaid.
There's two committees that are operating now, aren't there?
Well, there will be. You know, the Senate insisted that they needed their own committee. So the Legislative Coordinating Committee, which makes these decisions, went ahead and gave them the committee, gave them the time to meet. But at the same time, the coordinating committee also established what is more traditional, a joint committee between House and Senate that will then review what the Senate comes up with and come up with a joint package that they will then present to the legislature in January. In the meantime, though, I'm not sitting back and doing nothing and waiting for the legislature to act. We are continuing to work on, you know, tweaking what we presented last year and building support, because whatever comes out next year, it's got to be a Medicaid expansion plan that actually works, not one that is full of ideological pieces just to appease the majority or the minority. So I want to make sure that we stay on track and that we've got a proposal so that at least that something sane can be discussed.
Let me see if I understand the difference between what the 2020 session might offer for Medicaid expansion versus this year. This year, the issue was whether leaders would even allow the bill to come forward.
Right.
Next year, they're saying, oh, it's going to come forward. We're going to have a debate. But you're suggesting exactly what's in the bill might be up for consideration.
Well, as
here,
you know, the devil is always in the details.
Right.
And so what we need to be careful – and there are, unfortunately, you know, procedural moves that you can make to ensure that you never get a debate on a reasonable, rational bill, but only on a bill that, you know, has your ideological facets to it. So what we want to do is make sure that we don't end up in that situation where, you know, the legislature is forced to vote on a Medicaid expansion plan that really won't meet the needs of Kansans.
Right.
Will be incredibly difficult to administer, and, you know, in the long run, probably end up costing us more.
But this notion that leadership is going to block the bill from the get-go, that appears to be something that won't be in play next year.
No, I don't think that they would do that.
You know, again, going into the details here just a little bit and what you're referring to here, Senate President Weigel has said she's interested in adding work requirements to any Medicaid expansion measure and limiting coverage to only the very poorest of Kansans, maybe just to 100% of the poverty level. Other proposals have taken that up to 138% of the poverty level, covering more people. Could you live with provisions like that?
Well, I don't know. Work requirements, just flat out work requirements, no. Probably if we looked at work requirements with exemptions for people with chronic illnesses, mental health issues, those kinds of things, you know, that maybe. Though, quite honestly, Steve, with this population that we're talking about, almost all of these folks are working anyway, some of them two jobs. The jobs just don't provide insurance coverage.
And that notion gets lost in this conversation.
It does. It completely.
Doesn't it?
It's, you know, yeah. I mean, we soundbite it, but the reality is, you're talking about a population that's already working.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to what was the other issue?
Restricting those who would be eligible to just 100% of poverty instead of more than
that.
You know,
that could be a problem from the Center for Medicaid itself, the federal folks, because right now, if you only expand your program to 100% of the poverty level versus 138%, then you get reimbursed at the same level that we currently get reimbursed for Medicaid. So right now, the feds pick up about 55 cents on every dollar we spend. So we pay 45, they pay 55. On Medicaid expansion, the feds pick up 90 cents. But that you have to right now, you have to go to 138% to get that 100%. Otherwise, talk about costing us a fortune. It would cost us a fortune to expand if we're only going to get the 55%. So there are a couple of states, Utah being one of them, who has submitted a waiver to be able to go to 100% and get 90% reimbursement. So we're waiting to see what happens with that. I don't have a problem if we can get the 100%. I don't have a problem with doing that or get the 90% going to 100%. I don't have a problem with that. And then, but then providing subsidies for the 100 to 138 who stay in the private market. That can be worked out.
You know, this issue has been kicking around for a while in Kansas, and I'm wondering what your latest read is on the percentage of Kansans who support this policy initiative going forward.
The last numbers I saw were 77%.
77%.
It's huge. Yes.
And yet we're still struggling to get this thing through the legislature.
We are.
Yeah. The Senate Majority Leader Jim Denning said after the session that the uninsured really were in no danger because they could get excellent care and excellent coverage in hospital emergency rooms. What do you make of that?
Well, probably the same thing that our major hospitals think about that. You know, this has been a burden for our hospitals for a long time. It's this uncompensated care. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, they are required by law to take care of everybody who walks through that emergency room door, but they don't get compensated, and that's the problem. I mean, it's a problem not only for our rural hospitals, which we've seen close, but it's also a problem for our big urban hospitals who lose millions of dollars.
You know, one final point on this, then we're going to go to a break here, Governor. Republicans, meantime, they've expressed concern that you might try to expand Medicaid through some kind of executive order and effectively bypass the legislature. First, do you have that authority? Could you do that?
Steve, the irony here is that I actually voted for a bill that stripped the governor of that executive authority a few years ago.
Did it pass?
Yeah, it passed.
Okay.
Sure, it passed.
Sure.
Because I do believe this is something that ought to come through the legislature.
So no chance of you doing this through executive order?
Statutorily, I'm not allowed to do it.
Okay. Let's go to a break here. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Governor Kelly. We're going to talk about school funding and prisons and vulnerable kids. And we're going to take your questions, too, at 816-235-2888. Again, that's 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the program, we spoke with Kansas lawmakers about the state of corrections in Kansas. Unlike most places in the country, prison populations in Kansas are on the rise. That and other previous episodes, you can find them at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we're taking time off for Independence Day, but we'll return on Friday. We'll learn about the women you might not know about who are behind the creation of the Internet. That's Friday on KCUR. Up to date. Well, this hour, visiting with the governor of the state of Kansas, that's Laura Kelly. Our phone number here again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Governor, perhaps your top achievement this session was increasing school funding by $90 million a year, give or take, to account for inflation with rising school costs. How satisfying was that development for you?
Was huge. You know, I ran to be the education governor. So being able to fulfill that promise and adequately fund our schools and end the cycle of litigation is very satisfying.
And have you ended the cycle of litigation? The court has said it's going to keep tabs on this case going forward. It hasn't shut the books completely here.
No, and nor should they have.
I was going to ask you. Yeah.
No, they learned from what happened after the Montoy case in 2005 when, you know, we voted to adequately fund our schools and we kept that promise for a couple of years. Then we did hit the recession. It was difficult. But when we came out of the recession, instead of funding our schools, we implemented those reckless tax cuts, so and did not fulfill our obligation. So I agree with the court's decision to maintain jurisdiction so that if we screw this up, it goes right back to the Supreme Court. It doesn't have to go back through the district court process. So I agree with that. And it is my plan to every year submit a budget to the legislature that will adequately fund our schools and hope that they will abide by that also.
This notion that the court is still watching, do you think that sort of puts a level of pressure on lawmakers to stay true to the funding levels here?
I hope so. It should, you know, because we don't want to get back into court. It's time consuming. It's expensive.
Yeah.
It distracts from what we really need to be doing. So I'm hoping that they feel the pressure as I do.
And with this fight over funding receding a little bit, I'm wondering, is this a new day now for Kansas school kids? I mean, what does this mean for them going forward after so many years of fighting over money?
Well, I think it's important for our school kids, but I think it's also important for our teachers that I think, you know, and obviously those two are very related, but I think we're going to be able to pay our teachers a reasonable, respectful salary, which will help in recruiting and retaining some quality teachers. That clearly will benefit our kid, because I agree with others when they say the most important thing in a classroom is the teacher. And so our ability to really build our teaching workforce. And we can do that by both providing more funding for them, but also, I think, giving them back the respect that they're due as professionals. And, you know, so along with the funding, we're also working at that to sort of restore some of their rights but certainly the respect that I believe all teachers deserve.
Do you know off the top of your head, are we losing teachers still? Is that how big of an issue is teacher retention across the state?
You know, I don't know right this second,
yeah,
whether it's different now than it was 6 months ago. But I can tell you that the attitude is very different. And I'm sensing that teachers who are here are more satisfied, are hopeful, and very pleased that we're finally paying attention and providing them the tools that they need and also recognizing them as professionals. So I'm comfortable with that. But, you know, by having done the adequate funding, and hopefully we'll continue to do that, we're able to turn our attention to some other things that I think are important. You know, I've said frequently that I would really like my legacy as governor to be the establishment of the best and most robust early childhood education system in the country. And so we've been able to turn our attention now to some of that. We've got the Children's Cabinet under the leadership of Melissa Rooker has been out all over the state talking with stakeholders in a whole host of communities, really gathering information, and that will help us put together our plan for developing that system.
We have some early pre-K education in the state. What would the goal be, and where do we stand today in terms of trying to get that done?
Well, my ultimate goal is that that we create this comprehensive, robust system that will look different depending upon where you are. You know, we don't have a one size fits all. So what might work for, you know, say Shawnee, Kansas, might not work, you know, for Pratt, Kansas. Mm-hmm. So we really do want to individualize this and build on assets that communities already have, and fill in the holes wherever we can.
But the objective here would be to make pre-K available to every Kansas school kid.
I'm not just talking about pre-K. We're really talking about birth to five. So if you look down, I can give a perfect example is in Wichita. They have a program called the Opportunity Project that is a public-private partnership. There's a business guy down there with North Rock Inc., Barry Downing, who years ago decided that investing in early childhood was the right thing to do. Mm. And so he's done it, and he's got these incredible centers down there that really bring in families, even sometimes before the child is born. And they contract and say, we will be engaged, we will be involved. So the parents get wraparound services that they need to be good parents. The kid comes into the system, gets 5 years of really stimulating early childhood intervention. Those kids are going to kindergarten ready to learn, not needing special education. They're getting into those wonder years, when it's easy to get caught up in the juvenile correctional system. That's not happening with these kids. They're actually graduating their first class from high school this year.
Huh.
And Barry's a real data-driven guy, so we're going to have all sorts of information about how successful these kids are compared to ones who did not get that.
So something down this road is your goal.
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, I just had a conversation with Melissa Rooker, executive director of the cabinet, the other day. And I said, you know, whatever we're doing, make sure that we've got our business communities at the table because, you know, first of all, they're the ones who have the most to benefit. You know, we will be developing the workforce of the future. And so it's important that they invest in that. But also because, quite honestly, we need the help. We can't do this alone.
Kansas Governor Laura Kelly is my guest. Our phone number, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Steve from Kansas City, Missouri. Steve, good morning.
Hey, good morning. How's it going?
Well, thanks, Steve.
Yeah, so the news, the local news this morning reported that the state of Kansas had, I guess they said, like a surplus in tax collections of like $30 million some dollars. If that is true, is none of that money available for school funding? That's my question, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Governor?
Steve, that money is actually unanticipated revenue. It's $30 million over the estimates. So that was not available to be spent. That will be built into next year's budget, and you know, which we have not put together yet. But as we do that, you know, school funding will clearly be a high priority for this administration, and that $30 million will help. I will also tell you, though, as long as we're talking about it, that $30 million was just 1 month's estimate. Beating the estimates. We actually have done even better than that over the course of the entire fiscal year, which just ended June 30th. So we will be going into the next fiscal year with a nice cushion in our ending balance. But you know, it still means we need to be responsible and fiscally sound as we put together our budget because we can eat through that balance really quickly if we spend more than we take in on an annual basis.
I was going to say, because of a tax increase a year or two ago, tax revenues are up, as you're saying. The state has about $1 billion more in cash reserves, close to $1 billion now in cash reserves. Still, projections from the legislature's nonpartisan research staff shows that spending will outpace revenue under the budget covering the fiscal year that begins in July. The numbers suggest that the legislature appropriated more money than you had recommended. How big a concern is that?
It's a concern that I have, and obviously I'll be looking very closely at those numbers as we're putting together our fiscal year 21 budget.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's something the legislature needs to take very seriously, you know, and not try and look at being fiscally responsible rather than trying to score some political points. You know, I don't think the budget is something we ought to use as a political tool.
Speaking of revenue, is sports betting on the state's horizon?
I don't know. We came so very close this past session getting that passed, and then there was just a end of session roadblock that got in the way.
Do you want it?
Yes, I do. I think it's important for us. You know, we're competing with other states. Other states are going forward with this. I think it's something that we ought to have in the state of Kansas. It's not going to fund our schools or fund our roads or anything. It's not going to be that kind of revenue. But I think it's it is some. And it's also a sort of, in some ways, a service to our folks. And I think we have a responsibility to do that.
How would you like to see it managed? I mean, would you, if you wanted to place a bet on an NBA game, do I have to go to a casino to do it? Can I do it online? How would it play out? Or do you know yet?
Well, this is not my area of expertise, Steve. But I could tell you that, you know, my instructions to folks who are working on this, including
right.
our lottery and whatnot, is however we structure this, you know, I want to make sure that it's clean. You know, that's always the concern when you get into casinos and betting of any sort is, you know, can you do things that are not right or legal? And so I want to make sure we've got really tight guardrails on however we do this. And I think we will.
Back to some phone calls here. Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on the air.
Great. Thank you, Governor. I'm glad to meet you yesterday at the Bon Bon Restaurant in Lawrence.
And, it's a great event.
What, My question to you is, back when you were elected in the election, I assumed, and many people thought, that you were elected because your opponent, Kris Kobach, people said anybody but Kris Kobach. Can you please discuss that? And I'm very happy to have you as the governor of Kansas. I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks.
Well, Frank, I was not the only alternative to Kris Kobach, and yet the people did elect me. So I don't think I'm an anybody but Kris. I think that people actually elected Laura Kelly to be governor, and I think it was because I was really speaking to them. You know, I was talking about how Kansas and Kansans had been through a world of hurt over the past 8 years, and that all I wanted to do was to get into office and help fix that and make Kansas the wonderful place I thought it was when we moved here 35 years ago. So I think people actually voted for me, not just against Kris Kobach.
I want to turn to prisons. We, as I mentioned earlier, we talked about prisons on the show yesterday. I'm wondering, Governor, as we sit here in the summer of 2019, how concerned are you about the possibility of more unrest in our prisons, like the state experienced in 2017. I mean, overcrowding conditions persist. Guards are still working double shifts. We're paying them more now, but that helps solve that problem. But where are we?
Well, I think, Steve, it was in March when I declared a state of emergency in our correction system because it was. And while we have been able to take some steps to quiet things down, we still have a lot of very serious problems to resolve in our correction system, and we're working on it. Our permanent correction secretary just came on the ground. He came in from Idaho with great reputation, and we're expecting wonderful things from him. He just started on Monday, and he's going out and about. He's actually been doing some of that with Roger Warholz, the outgoing acting secretary, for the last month or so. So he'll be getting in and looking at these systems, but some things we've already put in place. You know, the salary increases were imperative because we were not able to recruit. We certainly couldn't retain, you know, when you've got your neighboring counties, you know, paying a whole lot more. So that will help. But, you know, that's not an overnight fix because it takes time to ratchet the staffing up. We have horrible overcrowding issues.
You're still over capacity, last numbers I saw.
We're not only over capacity, it's worse than even that sounds, because we're over capacity while we're double bunking people who should not be double bunked. So our capacity situation is even worse than it appears on paper. So we're taking steps to ameliorate some of that, and some steps that are not very popular, but absolutely essential at this point, because you know, safety has to come first. And we're looking, we're contracting with counties to use some county jail beds to move some folks out of our prison system temporarily. But we're probably going to have to contract for some private out-of-state beds just because the numbers are so huge. I mean, we're talking, we have to move hundreds and hundreds of people, not, you know, 40 or 50. So
how do you feel about that? Private prisons have the reputation they have for a reason. And how concerning is that for a governor?
Well, I've always opposed private prisons. In 14 years, I don't know how many times I voted against private prisons, right up until, you know, the last year I was in the Senate. So they're not my favorite. I don't believe in that model. But we're in a crisis situation right now, and the private sector is the only sector that has enough beds to help us alleviate this. And I have to trust Roger Warholz, the outgoing acting secretary, who took a team, you know, to these other states to look at these facilities. And as Roger would say, you know, there's a reason that private prisons have the reputation that they have. He said, but within that, there are some good ones. And so I trust that Roger and his team found, you know, ones that are reasonable substitutes right now for having our own system in place.
You know, the legislature has taken some steps to lower the number of inmates by taking nonviolent offenders out of the system. Will it be your recommendation that that process needs to continue and more aggressively? And furthermore, Governor, is it the objective of your administration to avoid building yet another prison in the state to handle this overcrowding?
Well, in terms of, we do need to do sentencing reform, you know, and there have been minor steps, but there's been no really substantial movement towards that. It's absolutely something that has to get done because we are incarcerating people who don't need to be incarcerated. At most, they might need treatment. I'm talking about low-level drug offenders in particular.
That's a hard move politically because a lot of lawmakers think they're would be looked on as soft on crime if they take that step.
Well, I think that was the issue 10 years ago. I think that issue is being replaced by the fact that we're incarcerating folks that we're pulling them away from their families, we're pulling them away from their jobs, their communities.
We're
we're sending them back having lost all of those ties. So I think people are beginning to understand that there's incarceration, which serves a purpose. You need to put certain people in prison, but there are other people who probably need to be in treatment. And I think a lot of legislators are finally getting that and recognizing that that's a much saner, sounder way to go.
Do you want to avoid building another prison?
At all costs. I mean, I shouldn't say at all costs. No, if that's what we have to do, that's what we will do. But I think I want to look first at every other alternative to that, including, community-based programs and, looking at, even the prison system that we have today. Is there a way that we can build in some programs there that really help us reduce recidivism? Because that's where, a lot of what we get are people who are paroled
just recycled
and then are coming
to the system.
Back.
Yeah.
And so what we need is to put in place programs in our prison system that ensure that, you're here, but what are we going to do with you now so that when you leave, you don't come back? And I'm really actually – look, I've started to talk with a number of different folks about really looking at prisons as we'll always need the lock them up, throw away the key approach. There are just some for whom that's the appropriate treatment. But for others, why not use it as a workforce training center?
Mm-hmm.
We have a workforce shortage all over this state.
That's what a lot of state prison systems are doing these days.
And we're doing that to a limited extent. I want to see how we can expand that because we know that if a person comes out of prison with a job, a decent paying job, connections in the community, they are so much less likely to recommit and be reinstitutionalized.
Do you feel like this has become a priority for the legislature, or are you still dragging them across the finish line here?
I think there are some legislators for whom this is a very high priority, and we're working with them.
Yeah. Kansas Governor Laura Kelly is my guest. Let's turn to vulnerable kids, Governor. One other thing that wasn't fully addressed this session was the lack of progress on reforming the state's troubled child welfare system. More funding for investigators wasn't approved, but other funds were cut. What are your thoughts and concerns there? This is a high priority for you.
Well, it's a very high priority, and actually, I think there's some sort of misunderstanding about what's actually going on. And Secretary Laura Howard has been meeting with some of these concerned folks. And, I served on the Child Welfare Task Force for 18 months. We put together some really very, very specific recommendations for change. And a lot of that is actually being implemented. I think, if we did anything wrong during that time, it was not making it clear, not communicating what was actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't hire just investigators, though. Legislature actually approved hiring of 42 more social workers. And these are the folks who can be working with our families, before kids get into our foster care system and keeping those families together and keeping those kids out of the system. They're also the ones that once a kid is in the system, they can be working for reintegration, either with the biological family or with an adoptive family. And those are critical positions that were essentially eliminated. And the ones that were filled with people who did not have the clinical qualifications that are really necessary to work with these very difficult cases. So, Secretary Howard is out there beefing back up that staffing.
So we got more social workers and we got more investigators, and you think that was an important step forward?
It's absolutely a very important step. And I think, prevention is always the best step. You want to keep kids out of the system. And so in addition to what we've already done here, we also have a federal permission now to use some a lot of funding that comes in from the federal government. Instead of just using it for kids who are in foster care, we're able to use that for family preservation, keeping the kids out of foster care. So there's a lot going on. Will there be problems in our child welfare system? Yes, there always will. It's just the nature of that business. But I think we're doing a good job really addressing those issues and putting in systems that will alleviate some of them.
The concerns in recent years centered on kids sleeping in state offices because there was nowhere to place them, kids who were unaccounted for. Social workers just simply didn't know where they were. Where do those issues stand?
Well, two things. One, with the kids sleeping in the offices, you know, what we've been The problem with that is that we eliminated a lot of crisis beds. So
during the Brownback years.
Yeah. I mean, I think we had 700 crisis beds. We went down to less than 300. And so there was no place to put some of these very, very difficult kids to deal with. You don't have foster care homes that are really geared up to handle kids with those kinds of problems. So we're working on bringing more of those beds back online. So we expect that will take care of that. On the other, if you go on the DCF website, we actually publish, you know, the state of the runaways. So we know exactly every day how many are gone, and we're out there doing what we can to bring them back.
It's a problem that every state faces, right? Every system faces. Kids, they get tired of their foster family. You know, they just hop up and take off.
I worked in that world early in my career, and you will always have runaways. That's just what happens. The issue is, how do you deal with it? You know, what do you have set up to try to avoid it, or what to do when it happens?
Back to some calls in. ML from Prairie Village. ML, you're on the air. Boy, ML, I can't hear you. I'm going to put you on hold and go to Deborah from St. Mary, Kansas. Deborah, good morning.
Morning. I was just wondering about the cannabis, medicinal cannabis laws. We seem to be losing our population in Kansas while we're not able to pass a medicinal cannabis law. And I was just wondering, what can we do to correct that?
Medical marijuana, Governor. Do you favor a change there?
I do. The legislature made a slight change this year by sort of taking away criminal aspects if parents are using CBD oils with their kids who might have epilepsy. So I think we're starting down that path. It's a slow process here in Kansas. I think there's still a lot of education that needs to go on, a lot of fear-mongering to be dealt with. And perhaps, you know, what we need to see is the legislature put together something that ensures those who are concerned about, you know, this being, you know, the first step to legalization of recreational marijuana, that we'll do medicinal marijuana in a very controlled, regulated environment.
I just got a few seconds left here. Last month, you promised an executive order that would end the so-called border war between Kansas and Missouri. What are we going to see you sign that thing?
I think we will have that coming out very shortly. We've been dealing with that. You know, I have talked to Governor Parson and about this, and he knows that we're as anxious as he is to end this war. I think we still have some issues on the local level. You know, the states can make an agreement, but we need to make sure that the playing field is level on the local level. And so we're working those out. Hopefully we'll be able to have something out soon.
Kansas Governor Laura Kelly. Governor, it's always great to have you here. Thanks for sharing your views with us today. Sure appreciate it.
My honor, Steve.
Tomorrow on the show, it's the 4th of July, and the UpToDate team is taking the day off. We'll be back on Friday for a conversation with musician and author Claire Evans. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR UpToDate. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we learned why we shouldn't be worried about the global helium shortage yet. Hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/UpToDate. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.